Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world today. We talk about where the world is going, and we talk about the future. And we take a fairly unusual view on those matters. We believe that there's a pretty good case to be made that the world might just be getting better all the time. We believe that if you look at emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, you might conclude that if you're not excited about the future, you're just not paying attention. And we believe that something is going to happen, something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Excellent, man. Doing real good. Excited about the show.
I'm having a bad day if I didn't say super fantastic. I fell down to great. So, we had trouble. It wasn't clear for a while there whether we were going to have a show tonight.
A little technical difficulty on my end. We got that squared away. So hopefully we'll get through this real smooth from here forward. So
well, this is an interesting situation we're in. We often have some kind of technical glitch at some point during almost every program. So we're thinking maybe we're pre-glitched, right? We've had all the technical problems ahead of time, and so the show will just be absolutely smooth all the way through. What do you think?
Michael Darling just texted me, Stephen, you got to pay your electric bills.
Yeah, you really do got to stay on top of those bills. Well, and the other problem is speaking of glitches, we have our chat host Michael Darling with us. He's not a glitch, but apparently the Blog Talk Radio chat function isn't working tonight. So what are you going to do this evening, Michael?
I just announced on the Speculist Facebook group that we're just beginning the show and the chat is down, that I'll hang out on Blog Talk Radio, and if the chat should appear, great. If not, well, I'll listen to the show and I'll be the peanut gallery. You guys can say, "Hey, shut up there in the peanut gallery," and that'll be me.
Oh, okay. All right. So as long as we all know our roles, this is kind of cool. Actually, we've got we always publish four time zones for the program, and it shows us to be kind of North America centric in our advertising because we put the four major time zones of North America up there rather than any of the other time zones elsewhere in the world. But tonight, Michael, as you pointed out in one of your emails prior to the show, we've actually got a person on the program in each of those four time zones. I think this is the first time we've spread it out across the virtual studio quite like that. We've got someone. Our guest is actually in Eastern Time. Stephen, of course, is in Central. You're there in Denver in Mountain Time, and I'm out here in California and Pacific Time. So we're really taking that virtual studio concept, I think, to its ultimate application here this evening.
Yeah, it's, our virtual studio is, you can be just anywhere, and it works out just fine.
Exactly. Assuming we can get internet. That's been the problem tonight, but we do have internet. We're on an hour later. We appreciate everyone who's listening to us live for sticking in with us. We hope to get the chat up and running so that we'll be able to get your commentary as we go into the program. But I'm going to go ahead, and we'll bring out our guest, and we'll get started on our discussion of a world of post-scarcity. So I'm very pleased to welcome Joseph Jackson to Fast Forward Radio. Joseph is a philosopher and social entrepreneur. He's a graduate of Harvard College, where he got his AB in government, and the London School of Economics, where he got his Master of Science in the Philosophy of Science. He's been studying open source and user innovation as a subset of the emerging political and economic phenomenon of peer production, P2P, since the Napster revolution of 2000. So he's been tracking this stuff for a while. Working at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society, he analyzed these themes in the context of digital media before moving to Australia as a visiting academic to observe the workings of a nonprofit research institute attempting to pioneer open source principles in bioagriculture. So that's quite interesting. Now leads the Network for Open Scientific Innovation, which is a 501c3 organization, and distributed think tank with partners in Brazil and Australia, coordinating a variety of research seeking to promote the emergence of open source models in the life sciences. Joseph is also the founder of a new journal just being organized, which is called Abundance, the Journal of Post-Scarcity Studies. So, Joseph Jackson, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Appreciate the opportunity to put the word out a little bit more.
You bet. Well, it was great getting the chance to meet you and speak with you, although we didn't get to talk too long, briefly at Convergence 08. And definitely had you on the list of people we wanted to follow up with on Fast Forward Radio. So as soon as I saw that you were moving ahead with getting your journal out, I thought, well, this would be a great time to bring you on and talk a little bit about A World Without Scarcity. This is a subject that we've addressed a number of times on this program. In fact, we've been talking about it fairly frequently over the last few weeks, so I think it's great now that we have one of the world's leading experts on the subject too.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I'm also wary of expertise, given the sort of P2P transition that we're going towards. So I won't claim any special, privileged perspective on this, but I have been thinking about it for a while. We're going to get some people that are going to say, what do you mean post-scarcity? We'll never be beyond, scarcity. It won't be possible to satisfy everyone's desires. I think one of my good friends who's going to be part of this project had an example talking about, if someone wanted to put a bunch of Titanics, replicas of a Titanic stretch all the way across the continental United States as an art project. I mean, how are we going to accommodate that kind of bizarre preference? But before getting into these sort of speculative, what-if type thought experiments, I guess it's important to try to say, what do we really mean by post-scarcity? I guess, my particular thinking on this was really motivated, actually, by my experience at Harvard. I had an intensely negative time there. I was really sort of puzzled by the time that I graduated, wondering how you had an institution with an enormous endowment. It was $20 billion when I was there, and then it's gone up to $40 billion. Of course, it lost $8 billion because of the current economic collapse, so it's down a little bit. But
the Harvard endowment's down to about $32 billion.
They've
I don't know how they're going to get
really
by
hard
with
up
that.
Now.
Yeah.
But it was startling to me to witness some of this, the widespread, frankly, it was sort of an epidemic of depression that was going on at the time. My first real experience was watching my roommate, a freshman roommate, kind of have some serious problems and implode towards the before the first academic year finished. And it turned out he actually had long-standing issues and with obsessive compulsive disorder, and all this was well known by the faculty and by the administration before they bought him, admitted him, but they really didn't provide for his needs. And of course, we were assigned to room together, which was a very stressful thing, for me to be privy to this. It was going on during that whole first year trying to adjust at college. And when I ultimately ended up confronting the administration or the deans about this, it was just a very unpleasant sort of stonewalling response that I was met with. And I dug into all the history of this type of thing and found out, there's a pretty well-known double murder-suicide from 1995 that occurred, and the parents of one of the girls did try to sue Harvard, and they ultimately settled it out of court. But there was really no actual meaningful reform about mental health policies and rooming situations and doing this for trying to really, what I thought was if anywhere could be a sort of post-scarcity utopia, you would think this place had the resources for it. And so
with their billions of endowment, right? Yeah, that they
right,
shouldn't.
And yet everyone was completely stressed out. And then at graduation, you know, everybody is all basically clones that are shuffled into consulting, investment banking, law, or medicine. So there's a very limited, you know, number of tracks for people that actually go through there. You follow this certain path, and now, of course, we've seen that evaporate almost overnight as Bear Stearns and these brands, these institutions that have, everyone has taken for granted for all this time have really just, you know, evaporated. So I found all this quite ironic sort of watch over the past 6 months. Anyway, that's why I really started thinking very hard about assumptions that I had going in, you know, to Harvard. And you know, again, at the same time with the digital media happenings, I was enjoying lots of free music on Napster before it got shut down.
Right.
And so I started kind of putting all these things together, thinking about it in terms of, you know, abundance and basically a prestige or reputation economy wherein, you know, what we really care about, I guess, actually is getting recognition for what we're doing. And I started, you know, just getting the gears turning, just seeing what was happening with music file sharing and how you could invert this model wherein, you know, during the industrial age, you know, this was an anomaly in the history of human cultural production. Everyone used to be able to make music, you would get together locally. It was only during this brief period of time that you had a whole industry that, because of the high costs, of course, of producing an album, and this created this whole structure wherein a few artists are identified that the executives think will sell well, and then they are basically foisted on us, and so I immediately saw this potential for, you know, kind of like what if instead of, you know, 550 whatever top big name artists, you had, you know, 5 million different people making, you know, music, and so I kind of thought about it just in these terms first, and then started looking around what was going on, free culture movement, all these different sort of movements that seemed to be converging towards this same kind of conclusions. And then as I started digging, of course, I saw these ideas went back a very long way, which, you know, begs the question of, you know, why is it that we are in this situation that we're in today where still so many billions of people live in poverty, and we've just seen a lot of our wealth evaporate in the space of a few months, apparently, as the stock market has started, you know, plummeting. And so I, you know, I realized the meme, these ideas had been around a long time. Probably one of the most influential proponents of this is Buckminster Fuller. And, you know, he really started talking about this, I think, about 1927, and he spent, you know, the rest of his life lecturing everywhere about the possibility that mankind can truly be you know, a success and can make the planet work for 100% of everyone. And this is not optimism, and it's not, it's just basically science, you know, because he argued essentially that that actual wealth is life support, and wealth can only increase because energy is fixed, it's conserved, and our knowledge, our know-how, is always expanding. So if we think of it in those terms, we should always be consistently getting richer. So the question then is, why are we having these booms and busts and all this unnecessary misery? And, you know, that's really what I guess we're trying to figure out with the launch of this journal, is to pretty much bring everybody together that's been thinking about this. There's a proliferation of different efforts happening now, and I want to kind of get it under one banner, so to speak, where we can organize our collective intelligence and wisdom on this.
So, you know, if we look at that, I like that Buckminster Fuller reference, and it's been a while since I'd read that, but I remember having read that a number of years ago that he had written about that. If we take that as a starting point, as a first operational definition, then what we're saying post-scarcity is a world in which all human beings, at least, basic physical needs are attended to. Is that a fair definition?
Well, that's one way of talking about it. And another way is to say that everything that's physically possible or humanly possible ought to be financially possible. And if you're sort of looking at our financial system, it has been built completely on these bogus scarcity assumptions. You make money scarce needlessly. This gets quite technical. I've had to spend quite a bit of time now just trying to understand what exactly money is. This is a very long, confusing history, and it doesn't seem like our entire, you know, the Federal Reserve really understood how it's supposed to function either. And, you know, when you get, I think of money really now as a socially constructed technology, and I think the way it's been implemented currently has been very destructive. So, again, I mentioned, you know, looking at the financial situation, there's a proliferation of attempts to do social currencies, to construct, you know, the new financial institutions that can better serve humanity. And we've seen a little bit of this. I mean, you've heard of microfinance, of course, and the Grameen Bank. We're talking about energy-backed currencies. I mean, there's a large variety of different efforts that are going on. So that's just one area.
Okay, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Joseph Jackson about the end of scarcity and the coming era of abundance. And if you're listening live, we may or may not have live chat going on. Michael, how's that looking?
So far, we don't have it.
We do not have chat. It looks like I get an error message. Stephen, you probably get the same thing. It just says the chat feature is currently unavailable and check back later. So it looks like we're going to be chatless.
Unfortunately, that is a Blog Talk Radio technical difficulty. So if you're listening to us live, please leave comments at speculus.com. We do have a blog post dedicated to this program. You can also leave commentary at the Facebook group devoted to the speculist. So, Joseph, as we're talking about this, one of the things that that comes to my mind is the question of what's between where we are right now and a post-scarcity world. That is to say, can we just tweak the way we're doing things now? Can we, you know, print money differently, hand money out differently, and we're in a post-scarcity world? Or are there technological things that have to occur? A lot of the discussions we've had on this program have been around things like fabrication technology and, you know, the ultimate goal of everyone being able to pretty much produce their own material goods, produce their own food, et cetera. Does that factor in before we can achieve, you know, quote, unquote, a post-scarcity world, or is it really just a matter of redefining the economy?
Okay, so there's a number of issues that you raise. A key concept from Buckminster Fuller was, you know, the idea of ephemeralization, you know, and he was one of the first really to talk about accelerating change. And, you know, this is the idea that when technology should be allowing us to always do more and more with less. And so wealth and prosperity began when a human mind or man learned to use the metaphysical capacities to master the physical. So he harnessed the energy of the universe to actually to do physical work by. And one of the first examples would be using the principle of leverage, you know, to lift a boulder or lift a rock, you know, that's heavier than what you can do with your muscle power. And as we've seen over the centuries, we've gotten better and better at harnessing that. Sadly, it's mostly been directed for in the 20th century, nuclear weapons were the ultimate manifestation of this, but in ballistics technology, being able to kill ever larger numbers of people at an ever greater distance in an ever shorter amount of time. And this led Buckminster to think we were probably going to annihilate ourselves if we couldn't switch over and start using technologies for life support. And now the depressing thing to realize is that instead of doing more with less in a lot of our critical areas, healthcare, education, we're doing less and less with more and more money and resources being poured into this. And I think for the first time in history this past year, like the average or cost of tuition at liberal arts college was $50,000. That's clearly not a sustainable economic model. You know, healthcare is in shambles. A lot of this, and I've been studying the issues of biotech and the patent system. If you look at the numbers on that, I think for 2006, there were about $600 billion in sales of pharmaceutical drugs, and only $50 billion of that was actually put into research and development. So it's a really costly way of organizing, you know, and supposedly incentivizing R&D when most of that expenditure is not going towards actually doing anything productive. So part of the solution is technological, but you can't adopt this sort of let's wait and see and wait for technology to deliver us attitude, and this is kind of a sometimes troubling tendency of us transhumanists to adopt this kind of thing of saying maybe, you know, a breakthrough a day keeps the crisis at bay. I think that there are several trends that are very encouraging. The advent of personal fabrication, 3D printing, a whole host of technologies on that front, it's already here. We won't have to wait for, you know, any kind of hypothetical Drexlerian molecular manufacturing. These other methods of personal manufacturing are already here, and they're going to present all of the same challenges that nanotech would as well. I mean, for example, you can already make do-it-yourself missiles. This is an interesting trend. A guy named John Robb runs this blog, Global Gorillas, that documents and tracks all of these kinds of examples of open-source warfare insurgencies around the world. And it's pretty scary reading, but good stuff. Synthetic biology, I know about biotechnology. Biology, you know, this has always been the cheapest technology, even cheaper than information technology and silicon, you know, on a, if you really do the cost basis comparison correctly. Unfortunately, we have made this artificially scarce and artificially expensive. That is starting to change. It scares a lot of people, the idea of do-it-yourself biology or biohacking. But it's here. It's not going to be stopped. It can only be delayed.
So we've got the capability, as you said, without something like Drexlerian nanotechnology to make, I guess it would be tremendous leaps forward in a number of areas. And per your point, there's also a good deal of risk involved. We don't need gray goo to bring the world down. If you've got the internet and people swapping ideas for how to cheaply build dozens of missiles or to
drones, yeah. I mean, the military is heavily going to automation and robotics. You've probably been watching. There's a good book about this that recently came out. But and then, I mean, open source drones are already here. Chris Anderson has a project. And all this stuff can be hacked, of course, and put to malicious use. But I ultimately am skeptical that you're going to get a technological solution to security. I think this is really a sort of a moral issue. I mean, really the best thing you can do to make us safe is have abundance as quickly as possible. And you take away the motivation for people to lash out. I mean, you can always, I guess, still have the occasional person that just goes on a rampage. But, I mean, even looking at what's happening now, we're having sort of spikes in crimes, several grisly suicides. One took place out in L.A. a couple of weeks ago, all due to this financial disaster, which was entirely avoidable, need not have happened. You know, another idea that's out there is the basic income guarantee. Basic income, again, has a very long history. There's been Thomas Paine, if you recall, from the founding of the United States. You know, he wrote a whole pamphlet on agrarian justice. It's just something that's been so politically difficult to establish.
You know, I have to admit that I didn't remember that Thomas Paine had written on the subject of kind of a safety net or a basic income for everyone, but I got an email from James Hughes to that effect earlier today, so I am familiar with the idea. That was a new one to me. I didn't realize that that idea had been floated at that time, and certainly not by one of our founding fathers, right? That's that is an unusual realization to come to. But let's look at that for a minute, because that is one of the ideas that that got tossed around quite a bit, I thought, at Convergence 08, and it seems to be kind of a fundamental idea of the notion of eliminating scarcity, of this kind of basic I guess safety net is the term that keeps coming back to mind. I go back to what you talked about earlier, how we seem to have more and more, and we tread water in terms of how much we can do with it. And to me, the analogy that comes to mind is that the first copy of Microsoft Word I ever owned was on a 64K diskette that ran on a 128K Mac, okay? Right. So, I mean, this was a tiny, tiny, tiny little piece of software. And basically, it did all the word processing that you would ever need to do, or at least it seemed that way at the time. Certainly, there have probably been a few items that have been added along the way that I appreciate and enjoy. Paperclip is not one of them, but, you know, those kinds of things. And now you look at Microsoft Office as it exists today, and it takes up gigabytes and gigabytes on your not gigabytes, excuse me. It takes up how much? Yeah, gigabytes. Yeah, on your hard disk. But we don't get, you know, it's thousands of times bigger, but it's not thousands of times better, right? The experience that we have is nowhere near what mathematically has occurred in that increase, and it seems like there's a real lack of efficiency in this tremendous growth that's occurred, that we've gotten the growth, but we haven't gotten the commensurate efficiency. And to me, I see the same thing when I look at something like the federal budget, right? Where it seems like it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and we pour more and more money into things, and yet it seems like at best we do about the same amount of stuff. Like the whole system seems to seems to be set up to just stop at a certain point. And I think, well, if we wanted to do everything we currently do plus make sure everybody gets a paycheck, I don't think we could do it. It's like it'd be like saying, let's have Microsoft Office do everything it currently does plus contain your entire movie library, right, or something like that. It's just like it's already getting too big and unwieldy, and it just does word processing. So, wouldn't we have to I guess that's a long lead up to this question,
sure.
But it seems to me that we would have to just fundamentally change how we approach the economy before something like that would even have a fighting chance to work. That bloat would just kill it if we were to try to implement it as a straight up everybody gets a paycheck, or would it?
Well, I think there's a good article on this that talks about it as a negative income tax, essentially. I guess, you know, to your concerns, one thing to realize is that I'd say probably even as much as 80%, the massive amounts of the economy are sort of completely unrelated to actual productive wealth-generating activity that's actually involved with supporting life and human achievements. We've had a huge expansion of these purely negative activities, such as insurance underwriters for other insurance, lawyers to sue other lawyers, all of these things. And I think the quote is Peter Drucker says, there's nothing so inefficient as efficiently doing that which should not be done at all.
And, exactly, yeah.
The idea is that if we had this minimum income, it allows people to actually dedicate time to their activities that, in the long run, thinking about innovation, for example, most of our advances have come from garage tinkerers over the years. The famous story about Ben Franklin flying the kite up wherever he discovers electricity, Edison and so forth. We've seen first of all, we don't spend very much, actually, globally on science. Looking at the figures, 2008 was something like $885 billion, so not even $1 trillion towards basic research, and the amount, think about what we've just given away in a few months. So we're not actually appropriately investing resources into what would really pay the big dividends. You've got all this money, all this stuff chasing what turned out to be fictional inventions, essentially, all these derivatives and things in the hedge funds. Nobody knew what they were.
Right. Actually, that was Ben Goertzel's point at Convergence 08. I don't know if you heard that panel that he was involved in when he said, instead of taking $1 trillion and using it to try to bail out a bunch of failed economic institutions, why don't you put it into, in his case, he was suggesting friendly AI research, but you could also talk about nanotech, or you could talk about life extension, or a lot of the different things we talk about here, and it seems the money would be much better spent going towards those kinds of things rather than chasing what appears to be a failing model.
I mean, the other problem really is that the promise of capitalism and the idea why it was such an interesting or a great idea is that you can earn from your ownership of capital. And if you really look at it in those terms, you realize that we've never had anything like an actual capitalist system, in the sense that a very tiny percentage of people do own the capital, and the rest of us are wage earners, wage slaves, right? So it's very peculiar. I mean, this is the theory of binary economics, was put forth by the philosopher Adler and Louis Kelso after the Great Depression, and it ended up, they actually pioneered the employee stock option. So that was the only real part of their theory that got implemented, but they had advocated for many much more radical and meaningful reforms. Again, I mentioned James Albus also did a book on this back in 1976, called People's Capitalism, advocating for this, broadly distributed ownership We've seen the Alaska Fund sort of functions a little bit like this. It hasn't been ideal, but it's an interesting history about the state of Alaska. I mean, they used to be a territory, obviously, and were sort of exploited for a long time before they gained entry into the Union. But they held their natural resources in this trust as a commons. And ultimately, you know, with robotics take off the way it's expected to, it's probably going to force us to something like this. And since you have enough unemployment, it can't be absorbed. The only way to do this is to grant, you know, widely distributed ownership and shares in these entities, so that the consumers are getting that, you know, paycheck, as we talk about that safety net or the basic income, and then can spend that to stimulate the economy and keep it circulating. Otherwise, you get this crisis of, you know, overproduction and underconsumption because nobody has any money to buy the stuff. So that's kind of a simplified version of it, but that's the gist of it.
Okay, well, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Joseph Jackson about a post-scarcity world, and we'd like your comments. Please leave them at speculus.com. So
I wanted to jump in real quick.
Phil, oh, go
that's
ahead,
right.
Steven,
I have this question, Joseph. If, you know, most people would want a world where things are more abundant, and that's, I mean, that's obviously a goal. But you also want to basically enrich the creators, those who are creative and want to, you know, and are putting things out there that are valuable to the rest of the world. We want to encourage them and make it and so that they, you know, I guess the big example, I suppose, is Napster, where, you know, for a time we all were enjoying lots and lots of great music, but those who were creating the music were not being paid for it, and so obviously you won't. I guess it comes down to this: how much, you know, should we charge for something that can be reproduced for practically nothing, and so as to encourage creativity but still allow as much abundance as possible? I guess finding the right point, price point, I guess, is part of this.
Sure, certainly. Okay, a number of different things to consider, and it depends on, you know, they've been trying to figure out new business models for quite some time. The industry really botched this. It's kind of probably too late at this point. I guess what I'd say, the main thing to keep in mind is to look at actually the history of intellectual property rights. The system does not particularly help the creator that much. It's almost always the intermediaries, the ones that can. So the music industry, if you did the breakdown, the artists never earned a lot from sales, royalty sales. On their album, you typically you sign a record deal. They advance you $1 million, whatever that pays for doing the album and all this other publicity and stuff. And by the time you finish, you're in the debt. You're in the hole to them quite substantially. And they mark up the CD, you know, $20 of that. You know, pitiful amounts went to the actual artist. It's clearly false that we need you've got to have this financial incentive as the primary thing to create culture. If you look at Hollywood, everyone is out there working a second job. They're all starving, you know, doing in the diner and trying to break into the movie business. So you effectively have this other stuff subsidizing an oversupply of wannabe actors, right? They're and then you end up with this blockbuster model wherein, you know, Tom Cruise and only, you know, a certain number of these big stars reap $20 million a picture, and there's nothing left for everybody else. Pornography, on the other hand, is a much more competitive sector in shows, you know, what would be like if people in Hollywood entertainment were earning normally, you know, at a more competitive rate, because the porn industry is actually sort of more analogous to the regular economy. Same could be said for professional sports. I think this model is actually quite inefficient. It relies on, you know, winnowing down many, many different aspiring athletes over the years, first through college. It's a very inefficient way of doing a farm league for your athletics, because basically you're having the academics, all that stuff subsidized, and the boosters club subsidized the sports team. And of course, it ultimately all relies on monopolizing your attention. It's all done through advertising. We just had the Super Bowl. But we could imagine a different model entirely, where you had a different, you know, many levels of sports leagues, local teams. People were supporting mainly their local leagues, their minor leagues. If you think about it in an efficiency standpoint, are we really getting the best and the most athletics for our dollar, the way the current system works? And not really. You're basically having a few people participating in athletics and a massive bunch of passive consumers. So that's just a little bit of my philosophizing.
Well, that's an interesting one. Say you had 1,000 baseball teams in the U.S. rather
right.
than a few dozen or a few hundred or whatever you have, and these are then these teams are made up of people who want to play baseball, right? And they've got obviously varying skill levels, but they're all working on it, and they enjoy playing baseball, and they're able to. They're supported in that lifestyle by collecting their safety net check or whatever. And I can, you know what, I totally behind that idea. I think it's great for all those people who want to play baseball.
Yeah, I mean,
to get
the... understand what I mean. It actually doesn't require $30 million to get Michael Jordan to perform at his elite level.
Yeah, exactly, sure.
It only requires whatever the amount is to let him play ball full time rather than his opportunity cost in another sector. And the thing is, I mean, it's a weird way to look at it. In one way, these guys are underpaid, in the sense that if they could simply charge their services globally to everyone, they could demand a $1 billion salary to play. So in one sense, the league owners conspire to be anti-competitive and negotiate against the union to keep the salaries down, even though they're obscenely high at $30 million or whatever for the season. But in the other sense, it's not competitive because the barriers to actually starting up a team are so enormous. You've got to have billions, whatever, to build these huge stadiums, and all that. It leads to this concentration and to the structure that we have. The pro leagues are structured in this way. I'm talking about sort of this hypothetical sort of abundance world where you have this bunch of local teams, and then maybe a few, you know, you still have a Super Bowl maybe, but just a radically different structure for the industry.
Yeah, well, you have to rise to the top in that system. I can see how that would be very appealing. But here's the question. Doesn't somebody ultimately have to do, you know, produce goods, right, to drive this whole thing? I mean, if everybody decides they want to play baseball or be a movie star or be a musician, or even if people hugely disproportionately decide that, the traditional thinking would be the economy collapses because you don't have people doing the work to produce the goods that will get that will create that whole safety net that you're talking about in the first place. Is the suggestion that we're far enough along now that that's all taken care of by automation, or that enough people would select to do the productive work, or that that's a canard anyway, that it's not actually necessary?
Well, you know, there's multiple assumptions that are going on here. You know, first I'd say we have the manufacturing industrial capacity to make enough junk to satisfy everybody with only, you know, a small percentage of the population of the planet actually doing these types of jobs. You know, most of our stuff, the consumption society, is a lot of manufactured needs. People are already motivated to do all kinds of productive activities. When you have this situation where people hate their job and hate going into work, that should be a sign, actually, that something is wrong, and we should be actually asking ourselves, you know, how could we restructure this task or restructure this to make it more like play, make it more enjoyable? And thus, I call this sort of, instead of a work ethic, this Pat Kane has written a book called The Play Ethic. Now, you're probably saying, oh, well, you know, that sounds well and good,
let me just say, it sounds awesome. Okay, I love the idea. I mean, we put on the blog yesterday. Stephen put on that. Which one was it? CareerBuilder.com. I can't remember who the ad was. The Super Bowl ad of these symptoms of having a job you hate, where you're screaming and you want to punch small animals and
you're crying all the time. And
yeah, crying uncontrollably. You know, the whole notion of having a world where that has been pushed off to one side so that people can do fulfilling things with their lives. I mean, that sounds great. I keep tripping over the math on how we make it happen until we get to the robots doing all the work. It seems to me, between now and the robots doing all the work, it doesn't seem like that would be a world that I understand how we would implement it.
Let me see if I can find this passage here where E.F. Schumacher is calculating, and this was back in the 70s, he was calculating how many of the world's, population are actually involved in doing any real production.
Like productive labor, actually producing
productive labor
stuff.
That's essential to supporting us. And it's a staggeringly small percentage if you run all of the numbers. And so then you end up realizing that most of what we're doing is just this complete, you've heard of Parkinson's Law, maybe. There's a famous example in World War II where this air base, basically they found out that 90% of what they were doing was just completely bureaucratically created complexity. And when the commander was sick or whatever, and all, it all just stopped and it ran itself perfectly fine. They stopped shuffling things from department to department. And you would be just shocked and appalled at the kind of supposedly necessary work everybody claims has to be done. And in fact, it's basically manufactured complexity.
Well, Joseph, isn't that a sign, though, of an abundance? The fact that I don't have to, grow my own corn.
It depends on how you want to, look at this. And the idea is, everyone want to be self-sufficient and blah, blah, blah. Look at Henry David Thoreau, of course. No one is actually self-sufficient. And when things... with this globalization that is so interconnected now, it's actually quite vulnerable to systems disruption. So a big part, actually, of the abundance economy may be a return to a lot of local production and satisfying a lot of your own needs. And we talk about solar technologies, biofuels, and these different distributed energy sources. It's actually a lot more efficient to not have to transport all this stuff around, which is one of the premises behind fabrication labs. It's really going to upend our whole 20th century model, which we're still using. Looking at the United States, it's just completely inefficient. You look at all the 18-wheelers trucking everything across country all the time, and that cost is not really counted because it's been externalized. in the form of, you know, the federal highway was built, all that infrastructure was built to support that, and that's why Walmart appears to be so efficient. But if you really start running the accounting, you know, this is what Buckminster used to talk about, using nature's accounting units and the amount of energy that actually expended. He figured you could afford to pay every person $400,000 a day to stay at home. But anyway, so it's...
I'll take that. That's a good deal. Sign me up.
The other thing to realize is that as the cost of this stuff plummets, you don't have to recoup this huge amount to have the incentive to produce it. So now that anyone can get a home recording studio that's equivalent in quality to the best, you know, professional stuff from 15 years ago, it only costs you, I think, $1,000. So you've got to factor that in as well. I mean, that's the most important consideration. And really our goal ought to be to make the cost of these activities collapse, as we've seen with blogging and, you know, publications that has threatened the traditional journal model. So we see a return actually to the amateur, and the word amateur of course means lover from French, and it used to not have a negative connotation, and now it's contrasted with professional. But actually everything used to be done by gentlemen scientists, and this is how the Royal Society, the first journal, was started. Unfortunately, even then, it was only the affluent who could afford their telescope to do astronomy, right? But now what we're working towards is, you know, a return to this citizen science model. That's part of what I'm working with in the do-it-yourself biology movement, which is trying to make these really cheap tools for home biology. So, yeah, I would say there's this tremendous...
Plus, you got a closing of the digital divide at the same time, so that anybody has access. It's not just the elite anymore, the rich people that can be the gentleman scientist. Anybody with inclination,
yeah, exactly,
can jump aboard. Yeah.
This is the other thing to remember, is that if only a tiny percent of the population is actually participating in genuine wealth-increasing activities, then we've only got to increase this by a little bit, and the payoffs should be enough, you know, to really support a leisure society for the rest of us. I mean, we would save ourselves plenty just in eliminating all the stress of these bureaucrats and people that are sitting behind desks doing needless things all day long, and then getting sick and burned out. And being, it costs us more in the long term to keep these people marching to these supposedly essential jobs.
Yeah, you know what's interesting about that, Joseph, is we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, and I think I wrote a blog post about this, possible end games for, you know, where we get when I was using scenario of when the robots take over, and it's either
right.
It's either that the we all just take a paycheck, right? We all become basically kind of something like the model you're describing, where the productivity that exists, we all subsist on it and do whatever we want, or we all have BS jobs. And actually, what you're saying, if I'm hearing you correctly, is that that's the world we live in right now.
Yeah, no, I would say it has been that way for several decades. No one wants to admit it. I mean, and that's just the whole. It's completely absurd. I mean, the best example really is the law, the legal profession. I mean, the lawyers are about the most parasitic.
Okay, now you know Stephen is a lawyer.
So.
Fortunately,
I have thick skin, Joseph. It's good.
I was going to say, fortunately, I do product marketing for a software company, so that is, nobody can assail that one. That one, airtight.
You know, the real goal of this, right, I like to compare it to, you know, what happened with computing. And you want people to be able to participate and be self-reliant, is that creates much greater value. When you had, you can think of it in terms of like, I have $1 million worth of X, you know, $1 million of computing power could only buy you one big UNIVAC, or one big mainframe that had to be time-shared. And we can take that same amount, $1,000 laptops, and you have 1,000 of them, right? So, and then you've got these network effects, and everyone is creating content, and basically a combinatorial explosion of value. And now, over time, computers have become simpler and easier to interact with, more intuitive to use. Hopefully, we're going to get even better user interfaces for the next generation. You know, you used to have to enter a command prompt, then we had a graphical user interface. Now, you know, anyone can use a blog now. You have the what you see is what you get editor. You don't have to be proficient in PHP or in programming language, right? The opposite has happened in the legal sphere. You look at through the trajectory of human history, right? Law is constantly more complex, and each law spawns another law about that law. You're saying, you know, basically the only good law that's ever passed is one that repeals a bad one. So is it really necessary? We've created, you know, a society of dependency and helplessness, and hardly anyone, it's particularly pernicious in the intellectual property field. Basically nobody knows what is going to be honored until it goes to a lawsuit. So you can pay a patent lawyer a fortune, and everyone does, to try to say that you're in the clear and not going to be infringing these things. But the fact is the whole system is completely muddled, and it's really reaching a crisis point, kind of analogous to what's happened in the credit collapse. I mean, we're going to see, we're in danger of this kind of a tsunami for our innovation being strangled by the explosive exponential proliferation of these intellectual property claims and litigation. And so the goal, you know, behind law, again, you know, it's a form of code, essentially. We need to be simplifying this, having standardized, machine-readable, interoperable types of contracts so that, you know, citizens can understand what they're doing, what their rights are, and interact with as few transaction costs as possible. And if you look at our basic freedom of movement, for example, we're much worse off than several centuries ago. At least then I could get on a ship, and if I survived the voyage or whatever, I could enter without a visa or an immigration problem. All of this stuff has been these artificial barriers to entry are raised. I'm just picking that example because I had a bad experience going into London without a student visa because I had not checked to see that this requirement had changed since I had applied for graduate school. Basically thrown in a detention cell with some other, like a drug smuggler or something, and then subsequently deported. So we have regressed, and every time I travel internationally quite a bit, I'm always having to check on visa requirements and pay at least $100. It's a typical fee. It's just a tax on free movement that the governments impose reciprocally on one another's citizens. It's a horribly inefficient way of doing things. So you think about all that.
I've always wondered what the big payoff is for anyone in the in government to make it so hard to travel from place to place, but I guess the payoff is actually the money. Well, listen, we're very close on our time here, but I've still got three questions for you, Joseph.
Yeah, okay.
So I wonder, can we work through those three questions? We
sure.
Might go a few minutes over, Stephen. If we have, do we have a few buffer minutes that if we run long?
Oh yeah, we can. We've got the time scheduled. So yeah, let's take the time we need to ask these questions.
Okay, I got three more questions for you. Here they go. In short order, the first one is let's go back to the fact that, to the idea that it's just a very small percentage of the population that does the productive work. Now, in a post-scarcity world, what if no one takes that work up? What happens?
Okay. I get, you know, I don't have the quotes handy, so I'll just paraphrase them. And, you know, I'm going to get into all the stuff in the journal. Hopefully we're going to hash this out. But the idea really, there's a couple ways you could do this. You could say, the way I think of it is, in the future, the ideal future, you will only have to do the things that you want to do. That doesn't mean, though, that at any given moment you necessarily want to do it. Let's say I, you know, decide that I'm going to be a pilot, right? I'm going to fly. I like, you know, aviation. This is a hobby of mine, but perhaps as a condition of the licensing regime or whatever, to get permission to fly and do this, I am committing to a certain amount of service per year, or whatever, where I'm going to fly commercial. I'm dedicating myself to provide this service. That's one sort of idea. It's kind of a rotating service model. And the other is that in the future, people will see being elected or selected to the life support teams as one of the greatest honor that can actually be bestowed on someone, in much the same way that the Olympics is taken as a sign of national pride. Well, not, you know, amateur athletics operates on that model. So I really think there's plenty of engineers and all these people out there. It's not going to be a problem to get the necessary stuff done. And anyway, that's just my.
So people would potentially maybe even compete to be the ones. They would take tests and the prestige. Okay. All right. I'm going to accept that possibility, as long as nobody's going to make me like go dig up turnips or something like that, because that's what I keep thinking is, well, wait a minute, if everybody gets to do what they want except for this few, you get this idea of this very poor put upon, you know, minority within the population who get tapped to, you know, to go clean the sewers or whatever. But you're saying that's not the model at all.
No, I just don't think that's a likely outcome. You know,
okay. Next question. We'll keep moving. I'll take you at your word that people will compete to be the productive ones. I like that picture a lot better than me having to clean the sewers. Okay. How about this? In a post-scarcity world, where people don't have to try to, you know, keep up with the Joneses, get ahead, etc. Isn't that just the ultimate welfare state? Doesn't the whole country become a housing project? I mean, wouldn't we lose our motivation to do anything, and we would all become just? I mean, we'd be bums, right?
This reflects a very deep-seated, you know, view of human motivation that's been beaten into most people because you are conditioned since childhood with reward and punishment. But, you know, if you think back to your earliest memories, you'll probably recall that you played spontaneously, and it was only, you know, once you're sent off to the factory school system that they start ringing the bells and doing this Pavlovian conditioning. Honestly, you know, I think that the best work, artists, hackers, programmers, you know, they view their activity as an art form, and it is its own reward. So I just do not think. I think the problem we have with people now are not equipped for leisure. You're so beaten down with this routine that no one has the energy or the autonomy left over to actually structure a life of productive leisure. So. Again, you know, I think this is us, you know, people looking at this from the lens of scarcity, being unable to imagine a bunch of actually self-directed and productive people because of the sad state and specimens that we all are now.
Well, and I know in my own case I'd be fine because I got my blog, and I just right. I mean, really, I would work my blog and I'd do this podcast. I'd do this a couple hours a day, probably something like that. So I don't actually worry about myself not having motivation, but it's interesting because I worry about everybody else.
This is a typical psychological thing called the fundamental attribution error, where you basically attribute your success up to your own, you know, your own merits, and then think that everyone else's failings or whatever must be, you know, intrinsic to them. I mean, this is a well-documented thing when you're asking people. It happens all the time. So I recommend just looking up that fundamental attribution error type. It's a cognitive bias that we have. And like, oh, you know, of course I would be.
I'd be great. Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure everybody on this program would be just fine. You know, I'm just, it's all them out there, right? That we worry about. Okay, so I'll take that. I like your answers to those, and I think this is something we could talk endlessly around. But rather than doing that, in the few additional minutes that we've got, let's talk very practically about what you're hoping to accomplish with the journal, and what steps are being taken now and need to be taken to move us towards a world of post-scarcity.
Okay, you know, the first thing that we want to do is just try to organize, you know, a theoretical basis for all this. I'd like to do that pretty rapidly so that we can get really down to the practical implementations. I mentioned there's a lot of projects going on already. There's one called a factory farm that's working on a, you know, a set of 28 technologies that can be done open source, manufactured in an open source manner, and it could sort of help us bootstrap, you know, to abundance that way. It could be deployed to villages, for example. I mean, we talk about the one laptop per child project, so we can think of sort of a one fab lab, you know, per child or per village type project. Those are sort of more practical, applied steps. A lot of heavy-duty engineering that's going on out there. And my goal is more to organize a kind of meta-level theoretical framework for this, within which, you know, those more technical discussions and projects can then proceed. So I, you know, I've been looking at different models for the journal. I like one that was done last year from the Journal of Virtual Worlds Research. So we're kind of going to implement the way that he's done it. You know, I'm trying to estimate what is the absolute cheapest, you know, that you can produce a decent quality journal. As you know, the Public Library of Sciences has pioneered an open access model of publishing. So we're going to do something similar, but it's social sciences rather than you know, the hard sciences. And yeah, you know, just kind of off the top of my head, I think it should be maybe about $10,000 to get it going and do the first year. So if anyone's interested in helping out with that aspect, you can get in touch with me. We're going to see how we're going to raise the money. I can fund part of it probably, and then a few other donations to get it going, and possibly crowdfund the rest.
Right.
And, you know, as I said, we're going to structure this by each issue will have a different theme of topics. So I want to start out with a lot of the big picture issues we talked about tonight, but going through the history of this. And as we said, it's quite extensive. So the first one will be to define traditional economics, what's wrong with it in the scarcity assumption, what is the abundance alternative. And we'll get into the meat of things issue by issue, starting out, you know, with the labor, the theory of values. We have the labor theory of value with classical economics, and then marginalism supplanted that supposedly, but in my opinion, it doesn't do a very good job. So we're going to talk about this sort of automation, you know, the role of automation and technology as the primary driver of economic prosperity. And then we'll have an issue on property, tracing again, you know, that's got a long history going back to Locke. You know, we'll look at these notions in the advent of what's happening today. You know, I mean, we could think about, you know, are we still going to have property when you can get a zip car, for example? I mean, you probably know about the zip cars, right, where you just pay per use on that, right? I mean, what does it make sense to own these things that are depreciating If you could just get things exactly as you need them from Houston. So anyway, you see the basic idea. It's going to move on from there, probably looking at energy. That's another huge topic in of itself that can be a whole issue devoted to that. So that's basically the outline for how things will proceed.
I've got an idea for an issue for you while we're brainstorming these. How about one about where everybody's going to live? Because I think once we're in a post-scarcity world, won't everybody move to Southern California or Florida or Hawaii or something like that? I mean,
yeah, that would be the last thought about what this will do to real estate. It bears remembering that our system, the mortgage system, that word means death pledge or on death
right.
terms.
Yes.
And you've got an entire system built on the idea that people are rooted to one spot, rooted to the ground, and can be taxed because they're in this jurisdiction, this county line, and all this stuff all the way up. Buckminster Fuller always envisioned this sort of mobile housing, these modularized, super lightweight, great mobile homes that could be detached, be transported wherever you want to go. And I say the seasteading guys, Institute, they're trying to build these platforms out there in the ocean. They're sort of talking a little bit about this kind of thing where you can float over here and then float off to another platform.
Yeah, that's true. You don't even have to have a house on the land, right? You're a seasteader. You're a pirate.
Yeah, but I mean, I imagine everyone will go to the equator or something. That's what I would do if I could just get a broadband down there and get my own biofuels or something else, some land I could hang out
Yeah, I mean, there'll be a few people who just genuinely, I mean, ski nuts, right? Ski people who like to ski and stuff, people who really legitimately like the cold will stay in other places, and I think everybody else will move to the center. So it sounds silly, but that's actually one of the issues that you'd be looking at there. I think there would be a huge population migration at that point.
Well, you would think, but I mean, it's amazing the extent that people stay rooted today in their community.
That's true. Yeah. And there might be motivations that we don't even look at or think about right now that would become very obvious in that world. There's a lot that we don't know about what it would be like to live in that world because we're still very much rooted in the paradigm that we have, I suppose. Well, Joseph, we thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us this evening, and we wish you the best of success with the new journal and with your efforts. We hope that we might have you back on the program at some
Definitely.
Point in the near future.
Yeah, I'll be glad to come on at any time. Appreciate getting to talk some. We could only kind of scratch a little bit sort of superficially on this, but I think it was all right.
It's a great start, and we look forward to talking with you more about it in the future. And I'll wish you all the best at the Bill conference. We didn't get
all
to
right.
talk about that at all, but we'll have a link on that. On the site, and if you have any discoveries there, we'll be sure and get those up on the Speculus
I'll definitely
as well.
Follow up. All right, guys, thanks very much.
All right, well, thank you.
Okay.
Stephen, what have we got going on music-wise this evening?
Well, I was just thinking about the music. We've been having a new song every week for the last 60 weeks.
We live in a world of musical abundance here on Fast Forward Radio.
That's right.
We're
all of this stuff is pod safe. I mean, they want you to take their music and rebroadcast it out to the world, and so it's just an example of a lot of people getting out there and doing what they love to do, which is play music, and hoping, of course, someday to make some money with it, but probably not making a lot of money now, just doing it mostly for the love of it. And so that's kind of what this band's trying to do, I'm sure. The name of the song tonight is Blue Skies / and Burn.
Oh, it started so nice. Okay.
Yeah, Blue Skies / and Burn. I don't know how they got that title. But anyway, it's Alamantra is the name of the band. And so that's our music tonight.
Okay, Alamantra singing Blue Skies / and Burn. All right, we'll look forward to listening to that. Stephen, thanks for hanging in with us this evening. Glad we were able to get the show together. Michael, thank you for your contribution. We hope to have the chat back next time. Thanks once again to our very special guest, Joseph Jackson, and to everyone listening. Whether you're listening live or you're listening to us recorded, we thank you for being with us, and we look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.